Good morning and welcome to state government, state and local government finance and policy. I call this committee to order. I call the state and local government finance and policy committee meeting to order on January 5th, 2023. Do we have a quorum present? A quorum is present. This morning, since this is our first committee meeting together, we are going to go around the table and do some brief introductions. What I would like to do is to ask our representatives to state their name and the district that they come from, and then, but we'll just go all the way around the table. So as we come to nonpartisan staff, please introduce yourself. As we come to partisan staff, please introduce yourselves as well. So with our newest member to the legislature, we'll begin with you, Representative Nadeau.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members. I'm Danny Nadeau. I represent, I'm newly elected. I represent the cities of Rogers, Dayton, and Champlin. So happy to be here and looking forward to working with everyone and getting to know everyone a lot better.
Morning, Madam Chair. Jim Joy. I represent 4B, which is Clay County, Becker County, used to be held by Marquardt. I'm excited to be here, first timer, and look forward to working with everyone.
Good morning, I am Bobby Harder, and I represent 17B, which is most of Sibley County, and parts of McLeod and Carver.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Represent Jim Nash, District 48A. I'll get that better. I'm accustomed to saying 47A. This is my ninth year on the committee. I think no one else has done that because no one else is up for the abuse. But happy to be here. Thank you.
Hello. Excuse me. I'm Ryan Wiskirchen. I am a GOP caucus researcher for this committee. I'm happy to be here as well.
Madam Chair and members, I'm Helen Roberts. I'm the nonpartisan fiscal analyst for the committee, and I have served the committee longer than Representative Nash. So.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. My name is Chelsea Griffin, and I'm a legislative analyst with House Research, nonpartisan staff.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. I'm Amanda Rudolph. I'm the committee administrator. This is my 11th year with the House, and I've previously been the committee administrator for GovOps, local government, elections, and state government.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Eric Peterson. I'm the committee legislative assistant for the committee, and this is my fourth year with the House this year.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. I am Representative John Hewitt. I represent 56B, new change like Nash was saying, that encompasses part of Rosemount, part of Eagan, and part of Apple Valley. This is my non-consecutive second time on state government finance.
My name is Rick Hansen, 53B, which is South St. Paul, Invergrove Heights, Newport, St. Paul Park, part of Cottage Grove, and Grey Cloud Island Township. This is my first time on the State Government Finance Committee in the years I've been serving.
Madam Chair, members, Kali Vanger, and I represent District 64A, and that's in St. Paul. To give you an idea of where that is, I represent St. Thomas, McAllister, part of Concordia, William Mitchell, and all of St. Paul College. So I'm full of universities, but I'm here in State Gov, and I'm happy to be here.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. I'm State Representative Jerry Newton. I represent District 35B, which is Coon Rapids and Andover.
Madam Chair, State Representative Mike Freiberg, District 43B, all or parts of Crystal, Golden Valley, Plymouth, and Robbinsdale. This is my third or fourth non-consecutive time on state government finance. Like Representative Hewitt, we are the Grover Clevelands of the State Government Finance Committee.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. John Beeler, DFL Research for the committee.
Thank you and welcome to everyone. For those of you I've not met yet, I am State Representative Ginny Cleborn. I represent Plymouth and Medicine Lake. Welcome to the committee, and I'm looking forward to working with all of you. I would like to remind the committee, Speaker Hortman has given us very clear directions this year. We are to work collaboratively, we are to do our work effectively and efficiently, and we are to be nice to one another. And I would just like to, I would like to echo the words of Speaker Hortman. Please do not mistake nice for weakness. We will do our work, we will do it effectively, and we will collaborate in every place possible to do good work for Minnesotans. And that's why we're here today. And with that, we will have our first bill before our committee this year, and that is House File 35, Representative Stevenson.
Madam Chair, before we proceed.
Yes,
Representative. Madam Chair, if I could, I don't see a copy of the committee rules. I was wondering if we were going to be addressing them and ratifying them before we actually begin committee work that those will dictate.
Thank you, Representative Nash, for asking about committee rules. I would like to work in a collaborative way about that, and as I have tried to reach out to you previously, and we've not yet had that opportunity, it is not necessary for us to conduct business without rules. Some committees do not adopt rules at all. I would like to have an opportunity to speak with you about the rules before we adopt rules. So we will do that at a later meeting. So thank you very much. And with that, I will now recognize Representative Stevenson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm pleased to appear with about House File 35, and I wonder, as I'm not a member of the committee, would you move the bill on my behalf?
Thank you very much. I move that House File 35 be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. The bill is now before us.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House File 35 is an important bill that undoes a budgetary gimmick instituted, unfortunately, about 20 years ago, relating to the way that MMB conducts the state budget forecast. As members might know, our budget forecast currently accounts for inflation in some aspects of the forecast, but not all. Critically, it accounts for it on the revenue side, but in not all aspects of the spending side, which has the consistent effect of making the state appear like it's in better fiscal health than it actually is. The analogy that I would draw for you is if you were a family putting together the family budget at the start of 2022, okay, in January, and you assumed as you're putting together that family budget that you're going to get an annual raise, that you're going to get more money coming in, but that throughout the entire year of 2022, your expenses were going to remain the same. Food wasn't going to get more expensive. Housing wasn't going to get more expensive. Gasoline wasn't going to get more expensive. If you made those assumptions in January of 2022, by the time you got to December, you'd be in a lot of trouble because inflation is real. And if you don't account for inflation when you're budgeting, bad things happen. And so this bill just simply corrects that. It's honest accounting. It doesn't appropriate any money or do anything else. It just gives us an honest picture of where we're starting. Madam Chair, there was a fiscal note prepared for the bill, and it has some big numbers on it. I just want to explain to the committee that those numbers reflect what MMB calculates inflation would be in the forecast, in the November forecast. So MMB's current practice, and I know the Commissioner Showalter's here, and I think he might speak a little bit to this, is to compute the inflationary number, but to not include it in the sort of top line surplus number. And so these numbers you see on the fiscal note reflect what inflation's impact on the forecast would be. There is no administrative cost to this bill. It's not going to cost MMB any extra money to do what this bill asks. So there's no appropriation necessary or dollars spent by this bill. The fiscal note simply reflects the impact of inflation on the projected surplus in the November forecast. And of course, that will change when we have the February forecast. So, Madam Chair, I know Commissioner Showalter is here and would like to speak to this. And I think there's a couple other testifiers as well.
Thank you, Representative Stevenson. And we'll ask the testifiers to please come forward. Commissioner Showalter, if you'd like to come forward, please. If you would please state your name for the committee and then begin your testimony.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Cleburne. Members, my name is Jim Showalter, Commissioner of Minnesota Management and Budget. Appreciate the chance to be here with you today. Just a few comments on the bill. I really appreciate the opportunity to speak with you about it. MMB supports including inflation in the forecast for state spending, And it's in line with how we deal with state revenues in the forecast. We think it's an important factor in presenting a reliable picture of costs and revenues, and so as particularly as we look into the future years. As required under 16A, 0.103, the state expenditure forecast does not include an allowance for inflation. The result of that is the forecast has an estimate of state expenditures that's not adjusted to increase costs for maintaining state services into the future. There's several exceptions to this treatment, and that's where the forecast gets complex. There's places where state law expects that price growth will be reflected in payment formulas. This includes special education, nursing facility payments, tax and property tax refunds. There are also places where it wouldn't make any sense to apply inflation, things like debt service, where those dollar amounts are set, because our interest rates are already known. The revenue forecast, however, does reflect the impact of inflation because that different treatment, the growth in prices does not, it affects revenues, but it doesn't on the other side of the budget, on the spending side. This understates likely future spending because price increases can result in higher costs and the erosion of ability to programs to deliver services to Minnesotans. This imbalanced view is only appreciated by those who are really deeply into the forecast. I admit that there's a lot of intricacies to the state budget. It's not understood by a broader audience. It's been this way for a while. MMB's Council of Economic Advisors is kind of a ad hoc group of advisors of economists. They've been commenting on this provision for years, pretty much since it first changed. And they've repeatedly pointed out in the forecast, in the letter, basically saying that the practice of excluding price changes on goods and services is fundamentally misleading. As of the November forecast, as Representative Stevenson noted, we estimate that 24 and 25, the inflation impact would be about $1.55 billion, $3.31 billion in 26, 27. And this estimate's pretty simple, just multiplying the CPI over the spending over those periods of time where inflation hasn't already been put in by legislative action. Prior to 2002, just going back a little bit in history, the forecast did include inflation. So this isn't like wildly unusual. This is in fact how it was done for many years before that. At that time, the impact was included in years without an appropriated budget. For example, in the current setting, that would be fiscal years 24 through 27. The forecast referred to it as discretionary inflation. That term is important because it doesn't mean that it's program specific. It's just that general price pressure that state programs are experiencing, and it was estimated by using CPI on general fund expenditures. So in 2002, just a quick history here, the legislature amended 16A to strike the language requiring inclusion of inflation in the expenditure forecast. This bill just undoes that change back in 2002. And as all of you've heard, there are a number of different programs, a different number of measures of inflation. Given that this bill returns to that prior 2002 language, we will use that same kind of general approach towards estimating inflation. Just again, thank you for hearing this bill and examining this issue, and happy to take any questions.
Thank you. I would like to get through the testimony before we address questions, if that would be all right with you, Representative Stevenson?
Certainly.
All right. With that, do you have additional testifiers? I have on the list Clark Goldenrod. Would you like to call Mr. Goldenrod forward?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Oh, Miss. Excuse me. If you would please say your name for the audience at home, and then please begin your testimony. Yeah.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Clark Goldenrod, and I'm the Deputy Director of the Minnesota Budget Project. The Minnesota Budget Project is an initiative of the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits, and we identify and promote policy solutions that expand economic opportunity and economic security to all Minnesotans.
May I ask you to please move your microphone just a little closer? Yeah. Thank you.
Is this better? Great. I want to thank Representative Stevenson for bringing this bill forward. We strongly support House File 35, and I'll mention a few reasons why. So first, it would make the forecast a more effective tool that gives policymakers, stakeholders, and the public a clear understanding of the state's fiscal health and helps them make better decisions. Second, it encourages responsible fiscal management. And third, understanding the impact of inflation is consistent with recommended accounting practices. So to that first point, that the bill would make the state's budget forecast a more effective tool for understanding the state's fiscal health. To be effective, forecast should be complete and give an accurate picture of the state's commitments. The effects of inflation are real, and including an impact, including an estimate of what funding would be needed for current levels of services to keep up with inflation, would help you as decision makers and the public to better understand whether proposed fiscal decisions are sustainable and to recognize how inflation puts pressure on the state's ability to meet its current commitments. And that brings me to my second point, that including inflation encourages responsible fiscal management. By providing a clear understanding of the state's fiscal health, the funding needed to maintain current levels of services, and the long-term implications of budget decisions. And finally, that making this change is consistent with recommended accounting practices. As Commissioner Schulwater mentioned, for every year since 2003, our state's Council of Economic Advisors had just recommended that the state's forecast planning estimates include inflation in both spending and revenue projections. They note that our current forecast methodology is inconsistent with both sound business practices and CBO, Congressional Budget Office methods. And it's important to note what this bill would not do. It does not make any budget decisions itself. The legislature would still have to pass and the governor to sign budget legislation to provide an inflationary funding increase in any non-forecasted program or service. It's important to use all the information available to successfully craft and evaluate budget decisions, including inflation in that toolkit, makes good sense. Thanks for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you for your testimony. Thanks. Representative Stevenson, I see also you have Mark Havman here is available as well.
If you say so, yes. All right.
Thank you. Mr. Havman, if you please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Mark Havman. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Center for Fiscal Excellence. We are a 97-year-old membership and charitable contribution supported research and education organization supporting sound tax policy, efficient spending, and accountable government. For those who are unfamiliar with us, the way I guess I'd try to distinguish our organization from many of the other fine public policy nonprofits that exist in the state is that we generally refrain from taking positions on levels of taxation and spending because our organization was founded on the belief that citizens get to make that call through their elected officials. But what we're about is to try to ensure that the revenue system that supports that spending adheres to good public finance principles and sound tax policy, that the spending that's done is efficient, accountable, and accomplishes what it's supposed to accomplish. So this is a topic that we have studied for a very long time and written about for a very long time. 2005, actually, was the first time we did this. And we concluded that this actually is a much more complex issue than is usually portrayed and conveyed. We came at the issue from the standpoint of neutrality, asking what approach actually introduces the least amount of bias into the budgeting process. We acknowledge that there are valid points on both sides of this argument. But we concluded then, and still do, that the practice of including it as supplemental information, but giving a much higher discussion profile than it currently exists, received in the forecast, best serves this objective. Just a couple of fact groundings here that I think are important to understand. The discussion of putting it into the forecast is really not the best way to describe it. It's in the forecast. That number, $1.552 billion, is there for all you to see, for the legislature to discuss, to contemplate, to debate, in terms of what should be done with that estimate. And it's important to do that. It is vitally important to do that. As a matter of fact, we were disappointed during a supplemental budget year that inflation didn't get the attention that it deserved last year when rates were at 8% or whatever the case may be. The other issue is that what is being debated today or discussed today is the exception in state history rather than the rule. A return to this from 2002 when it was taken out, it was put in place in 1991. So only for 11 years in state history has this proposal, this approach been in place. So the issue for us is not a debate whether or not to recognize it. Of course, it's critically important to recognize it. The debate is how to recognize it. And the question is, what happens if you move a $1.55 billion figure from the bottom of the page into the MMB line item labeled projective spending? And what happens is you create a situation where budget development starts from an official baseline where available resources don't exist because the majority of government discretionary spending has been formally indemnified against inflation. The point that is frequently made, and accurately so, this does not commit the state to any inflation adjustments. What it does, it creates a starting point in a balanced budget process that assumes you will do this. And that's critically important, because there are a couple of important implications that fall from this. The first is that a planning tool becomes a potential potent budgeting tool. I'm quoting from a House research, House fiscal brief from the early 2000s. Planning estimate inflation has also been a tool to provide more flexibility for a governor and legislature in assembling a new budget. The inflation creates a cushion, their words, not ours, of several hundred million dollars that is already counted as spending in the budget forecast. And I would note that amounts to $1.55 billion a day, which is a very comfortable cushion, to say the least. In one example from state history, during the 11-year period when this policy was in place, $800 million of planning estimate inflation was set aside for inflationary adjustments. The governor recommended just under $100 million for various inflation-related base adjustments to state agency operations. The remaining $700 million was available for adjustments to other budget areas. So what happens that including inflation enables a lot of new spending, a brand new spending on expanded programs or new programs, without ever having to properly recognize it as new government spending. And that new spending will then have spending have their own tails and their own inflationary projections going forward. The other concern that we have is that it disincentivizes base budget scrutiny while creating an unsubstantiated perception of what the real cost of providing a service is and what full funding of a service requires. Expenditure inflation in the forecast does not communicate the real cost of government services. It crudely communicates the costs of how these services are provided today, the cost of maintaining the status quo in government service delivery. We believe this removes any incentives that do exist for base budget scrutiny and reforms that promote greater efficiency in government operations and service delivery. So in short, we think this does create a bias in what should be a neutral budgeting process, and we encourage that the treatment of inflation be given very serious consideration, but remain as it is currently in the state economic forecast. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. I appreciate it. Are there any other individuals who wish to testify on this bill? Seeing none, questions from the members? Seeing no questions. Excuse me, Representative Herr. Representative Herr.
Madam Chair, thank you. And Representative Stevenson, I'm just curious. So it looks like here that CPI is the inflation numbers will be based on CPI. And I guess I'm just curious why not PCE? Like CPI only reflects direct cost to consumers, whereas PCE is actually more comprehensive. And so, like for example, healthcare is factored into the PCE, and it has, you know, it makes up about 22% of that index, but it's only 9% of CPI, and I guess I'm just curious as to what was the decision as to why one index versus another one.
Representative Stevenson.
Madam Chair, Representative Herr, so the bill is silent as to the measure of inflation that MMB would use. MMB uses CPI in their current calculations, so I'm going to ask if that question could be answered by MMB more appropriately. My bill does not prescribe what measure of inflation MMB would use. I think it's a good and fair question, but I think Commissioner Showalter or others might be better equipped to answer that question.
Again, if you'd please state your name for the record.
Absolutely. Jim Showalter from MMB. Madam Chair, Representative, a great question. CPI was what was used back previously, so I think we've just resumed those prior practices. You're absolutely right. There's a number of different indices that we could use. I think CPI is probably the most general, and we'd revert to that practice. But there's certainly different alternatives that would be available. As the author suggested, You know, the bill itself is silent to that. And part of the conversation and work that would be ahead is the conversation between MMB, legislative staff of both bodies, to make sure that we're working off of commonly accepted and appropriate principles. So, you know, I think that is one of those ongoing discussions of what's the right way, what's the best way to reflect the impact of inflation.
Thank you. Just
a quick statement, Madam Speaker, and I appreciate the flexibility and the ability to look at different indices. I just think, as we think about just not a direct cost to consumers, but really there are a number of other costs that should be taken into consideration in rising healthcare costs and the impact it has on individuals and their ability to spend, and what it looks like for the state. And I just think that it would be a much better, much more accurate reflection of that. And I think if we want to have good numbers and good projections, using something that I think is a more conservative number, which would be helpful in this process, would be something to think about. So thank you so much.
Since some members and audience attendees arrived late, I just want to remind everyone in the room that we are going to adjourn today at 9:45. Representative Bonner, I understand you have a question. First statement.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess this will come back to you again with at MMB. I personally work in the IT field as a project manager, a team lead, and so forth. And I know that it is very common practice in a lot of businesses to make sure that we have accounting for things like contingencies or factors that might impact the budget down the road. I think that's pretty standard, pretty common practice across the board. And I know that when we're out talking to folks out in the community, even though we have that asterisk in place, that oftentimes that gets lost. And I don't think the general public generally hears the asterisk. But my question is this. When budgeting in say, a project management standpoint, we often really don't have good indicators to know what those measures might be. So we usually use standard contingencies. But in this case, we have a number of different indexes that you can use to try to calculate inflation. Can you just tell me a little bit about how reliable those are and how those might be really helpful in using that as a tool to determine how much money we really do have in the budget so that we are really not spending money that we don't have and being fiscally responsible?
Commissioner?
Chair, Representative, great question, and you're absolutely right. I would think of it as the different layers of risk, and from the forecast view, this is like the simplest, highest level of how much is available, what's happening with the economy, what are the revenues, what is the spending, and inflation is kind of at a very simple level, a element of the pressures. We do prepare a report on a regular basis about the volatility of our revenues, and so that is one estimate of that shows sort of historically what's our confidence interval of the revenues that we're budgeting or showing in the forecast, because it is a point estimate, it's not a range. So that's a sort of one piece of information that I think might be useful for that question of what's the contingencies, what's the risk. The other part is from the state's perspective that we have very mature and sort of well-known processes, so that there's not a lot of transmission problems of understanding what the information is, because we do it the same way. So you get a sort of familiarity. And then third is obviously reserves. And the state has a significant budget reserve. It's been developed and grown over the last decade. It's really an important tool because there is volatility in economic activity as well as some of the demands on the state. So those are at the very highest level. As you move down into the project level, it becomes more complex. And the admonition is really simple. Appropriation is the limit of the resources that are available to the manager, to the agency head, for the tasks that it has at hand. So, at all times, that is the cap. And to the extent that the project can't be done or has to be scaled back, that is on the agency to do, or come back to the legislature in succeeding sessions.
Thank you. I would like to remind members that when someone is speaking and testifying to the committee, it is a respectful practice to not have side conversations. So I ask that you please give our testifiers the respect that they deserve in committee. Thank you. Our next question is from Representative Kosnick.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Apologize, the roads were needing a little work yet this morning, but made it here. Representative Stevens, there's been a little discussion on there's not defined what the inflation factor index will be in here. But if we could talk about the, looking at the fiscal note, I know I don't think we went over that, did we, Madam Chair?
If you have a question, please raise your question.
Yeah, the question is, did we go over the fiscal note? I came in a little late to the committee.
We have discussed the fiscal note, yes.
I'm sorry?
Yes, Representative Kosnick.
Okay. Looking at it, looks like it's, 1.5-some billion for the next biennium and 3.3 in the following biennium. So is this basically growing government on an automatic basis? He's shaking his head. If you could comment, I'd appreciate
Excuse me, Representative Kosnick, to whom are you asking your question?
The author, I said Representative Stevens.
Thank you. I did not hear that. Representative Stevenson.
Thank you, Chair Cleaborn and Representative Kosnick. I did address this issue in my opening statement. The numbers in the fiscal note reflect what MMB's projection for inflation would be in the next two bienniums. So it's saying that the amount of the projected surplus would be reduced by $1.5 billion in the net first biennium and 3.3 in the tails. This bill does not appropriate any money, and there's no administrative cost to MMB to do this calculation, because they already do it. It's just changing how it's reflected in the forecast documents. So what the fiscal note is telling you is that if we enact this bill, the projected surplus will be smaller in the next biennium by $1.5 billion because we'll be accounting for inflation, but it doesn't actually spend any money. So no, and I think you've heard testifiers both for and against this proposal tell you that this bill doesn't put anything on autopilot because it doesn't appropriate any money. It just is, from my perspective, a more honest accounting of where the state sits from a fiscal perspective.
Madam Chair, thank you. And Representative Stevens, I appreciate the answer. And looking at the fiscal note, it does note that the legislature would still need to determine how to allocate and appropriate the inflationary amount. So I think there's some concerns there, and that would be my concern as well.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So my question has to do with what is the common practice in other states? Do they anticipate inflation on both sides of the equation moving forward for their budget estimates? Do you know? I don't think anybody here wants to, just automatically have automatic spending increases. And at the same time, I think people want to be reasonable about, what those anticipated revenues are. So would we, in order to have it to be balanced, I have two questions. Would it be just as effective to eliminate inflation from our revenue estimates to create that balance? That's one question. And then number two is what do other states do when it comes to inflation calculations for expenditures?
Representative Stevenson, and I'm going to ask you to be brief in your answer, please, yep. So that we can move on.
Yep, Madam Chair, Representative Nadeau, it would not be better to take inflation out on the revenue side. That would take us further away from reality, not closer to it. Inflation exists. We should recognize it. As to your second question, I couldn't give you a comprehensive survey of all 50 states. I do believe, and I think Commissioner Showalter is nodding his head, that other states do this practice. It was suggested earlier by one of the testifiers. This is what the Congressional Budget Office does. And I think you'd be hard-pressed to find a business that didn't budget accounting for inflation in their businesses. They probably wouldn't be in business very long if they did that.
Just one follow-up.
Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do counties, in their budgeting process, do they anticipate and budget for inflation? Do you know?
Representative Stevenson.
Chair Cleaborn, Representative Nadeau, I bet you might know from your prior experience. I do not, and I don't know if Commissioner Showalter doesn't either, but I know that you worked in county government for a while, so I maybe you know.
I don't. I don't think they do. That was my question. I just thought maybe the commissioner knew. So thank you, Madam Chair. I really appreciate it.
I do want to remind the committee and the audience today that we are going to recess at 9:45. If we have to come back at a later time today, we will do so. So I ask that we please keep our questions and comments as brief as possible going forward. Representative Nash.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I will try to be brief to keep you on your schedule. We've had this bill before. I've opposed this before. I will continue opposing this. Would encourage my side to also oppose this. It goes back to, I think, the general presumption that this is reflected already, and that this body that we serve in is responsible to figure out budgets and to set budgets and to work through that, and that here in committee and in the next committee stops and on the floor that we will debate those issues and we will have those conversations. I think what this does is it creates a little bit of a callus and makes it easier to increase spending moving down the road. I think that the best thing that we can do for Minnesotans is to have full-throated conversations, whereas my math teacher naggingly reminded me that even if I knew what the answer was going to be, I had to show my work. I always got docked for that. I think that this is the place that we show our work, and that in committee we have these conversations. And for those that have never experienced the governor's budget, it's a lot of fun. Not really, but we go through line item by line item, and we do talk about these things, and it is accounted for now. So we should have those conversations and not make it, as I believe the testifier from the Minnesota Center for Fiscal Excellence said, it effectively makes it easier to ignore the pressures, and I want to have those conversations. So, Madam Chair, I will be voting no. I encourage my members to vote no, and I would request a roll call.
Thank you. A roll call has been requested. Representative Stevenson, would you like to have final closing words on your bill?
It's a good bill. Please vote yes.
All right. If the CLA will please take the roll. Oh, excuse me. I'd like to renew my motion to refer House File 35 to the Committee on Ways and Means. Will you please take the roll?
Chair Cleavorn?
Aye.
Cleavorn, aye. Vice Chair Hewitt?
Aye.
Hewitt, aye. Representative Nash?
No.
Nash, no. Representative Bonner?
Aye.
Bonner, aye. Representative Berg?
Berg, aye.
Berg, aye. Representative Freiberg?
Yes.
Freiberg, aye. Representative Hansen?
Aye.
Hansen, aye. Representative Harder?
No.
Harder, no. Representative Herr?
Aye.
Herr, aye. Representative Joy?
No.
Joy, no. Representative Kosnick?
No.
Kosnick, no. Representative Nadeau?
Aye.
Representative Nadeau, aye. Representative Newton?
Aye.
Newton, aye. That's 9 ayes and 4 nays, Madam Chair.
With 9 ayes and 4 nays, House File 35 is on its way to Ways and Means. Thank you, Representative Stevenson.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Now we were on to item 4 on the agenda, which will be the presentation by Attorney General Keith Ellison. If you'll please come to the podium. Please state your name for the record and begin your testimony. Thank you.
My name is Keith Ellison, and I'm the Attorney General for the state of Minnesota. And it's certainly an honor to be here with you, Madam Chair. Let me also thank Vice Chair Hewitt and Ranking Member Nash for allowing me to be present with you all today. The Minnesota Constitution establishes the office of the Attorney General to serve as the state's chief legal officer. The role and duties of the Attorney General arise from the Minnesota Constitution. The statutes of the state, and notably Chapter 8 in particular, common law and case law. The Attorney General has 5 primary responsibilities. First, the Attorney General is required by the state statutes 8.06 to represent the more than 100 state agencies, boards, and commissions in litigation and in other legal matters. We work every day to provide excellent legal representation to the state, though much of this work does go unnoticed by the press and the public, it is essential to running the state of Minnesota. Second, the Attorney General also protects the people of the state of Minnesota by bringing lawsuits on behalf of Minnesota residents as the chief enforcer of the state's consumer protection statutes, antitrust laws, charities laws, and other, including utility interests that consumers have. In Minnesota statutes 8.31, the legislature directed the Attorney General to investigate and prosecute, quote, violations of law of this state respecting unfair, discriminatory, and other unlawful practices in business, commerce, or trade. There are many other specific statutes that legislature has passed that gives the Attorney General the authority to protect Minnesota consumers. We also, as I noted, protect consumers and small businesses by representing their interests at the Public Utilities Commission. Third, the Attorney General plays an important but defined role under Minnesota Statutes 8.01 in supporting county attorneys in criminal prosecution and criminal appeals. Most commonly, we do this on behalf of smaller counties, but we might do it for any county in the state when asked. We're strictly involved in criminal prosecution by invitation or appointment by the governor. We have no authority to just walk into a county and take over a prosecution. In fact, we need a letter in writing before we can do that. Fourth, the Attorney General also defends duly passed constitutional laws of the state against legal challenges. Fifth, and finally, the Attorney General serves on a number of boards and commissions, executive committee, state board of investment, the board of pardons, things like that. To sum it up, the Attorney General's office helps Minnesotans afford their lives and live with dignity, safety, and respect. Let me talk a little bit about how we do our work and how we're organized. Now, currently, we have about 340 hardworking employees. Approximately 40% are attorneys. The remainder are legal assistants, including investigators, our consumer action division, mediators, financial analysts, and support staff. The legal side of the office is organized into four overarching sections, and each is led by a deputy at the Attorney General's office, including the Solicitor General. So the Consumer Protections led group is led by an excellent lawyer named James Kennedy. Health and Safety is led by David Voigt, who does a wonderful job. Government Support is led by Luz Maria Frias, who does a wonderful job, and our Solicitor General's Liz Kramer. Each section has divisions underneath it, and it is organized around subject matter and client agencies. Because we have limited time today, I won't go into the duties of each one, but I would like to highlight at least some of these, because of these four divisions that I just outlined, there are 19 divisions shared among those four. The first I mentioned is Consumer, Wage, and Antitrust, which investigates violations of and enforces state laws, including Minnesota's laws prohibiting consumer fraud, deceptive trade practices, false advertising, and wage theft. I want to thank the legislature for passing a wage theft law recently. It was very important, very helpful to Minnesota consumers and workers. The division also and businesses who are high road and who abide by the law. The division also investigates potential violations of state and federal antitrust laws and enforces these laws when it uncovers evidence of anti-competitive conduct. This is the division that has held the opioid companies accountable, protected tenants from predatory landlords, protected students from fraudulent and deceptive practices by certain schools and lenders, protected consumers from deceptive marketing and door-to-door sales tactics, and held major corporations like drug manufacturers accountable for illegal anti-competitive behavior. Our statutory authority to do this work derives from Minnesota Statutes 8.31, as I noted earlier. Also, the Consumer Action Division, I'd like you to know about, serves two primary functions. First, it answers calls, correspondence, and online complaints from people, businesses, and organizations who contact us for help. Staff answer phones live 40 hours a week to provide information and to talk through consumer-related concerns, help constituents locate government agencies, and direct people to useful information. I'd like you to know that last year, fiscal year 2022, this group fielded more than 52,000 calls. And in 2020, they did over 80,000. So they get, so when consumers are calling over their bill and have questions and hit a phone tree and are online, on the line for 40 minutes trying to get an answer to their question because their bill doesn't look right, they can always turn to us and our office answers those calls. In fact, we have handled, we have resolved more than 14,000 files and mediated settlements worth over $10 million in the last 4 years. Over the last 4 years, we've gotten a total of $26 million back into the pockets of Minnesota consumers. So that money doesn't go to the general fund, it goes back into families' budgets, and that's important. Charities Division is required by state law to maintain a public registry of charities, charitable trusts, professional fundraisers that operate in the state, oversee and regulate all charities and charitable trusts, including nonprofits active in Minnesota, and enforce charitable organization solicitation, charitable trusts, and nonprofit laws. We also have under our consumer group a special outreach unit, which focuses on investigating and bringing enforcement actions to stop and deter deceptive and unlawful practices that target groups that have certain social, economic, linguistic vulnerabilities. So, for example, there are people, because they may not speak English or because they might not have, you know, because they just don't have a culture of using government, that they might not even know we exist. So our unit does outreach to them. And we've done a number of things to help tenants in this area. And, of course, I want you to be aware of our Residential Utilities Division, which is mandated under Minnesota Statute 8.33 to represent the interests of residential and small business utility companies at the Public Utilities Commission. The Attorney General's office is the only thing standing between the consumer and the utility company asking for more, for higher rates. And we do our job with vigor and professionalism. Criminal Division. It is important to note that we have a well-defined but important criminal division. Under Minnesota Statutes 8.01, as I noted, we support the 87 counties, including Hennepin and Ramsey, but also Brown County, Pennington County, the smallest counties in the state, Lake of the Woods County. When they need us, we show up. I'd like you to know that when Skip Humphrey was here, we had 12 criminal prosecutors. We got down to one when I got here. We boosted those up to three full-time. We have a lot of other, we have three others who do appellate work. I'd like you to know that I think that there's a lot more we could do, and we don't like it when we have to tell counties, we'd love to help you, but all of our people are booked. And that's a problem that I hope to solve this session, though that is not the topic for today. In the last 4 years, my office has taken on and prosecuted 47 serious violent crimes in 22 counties, and I'm proud to say we have never lost. Second, the criminal division often assists counties in criminal appeals. This is very important. This helps shape the law and determines what the law is, often upholding statutes that you have passed. And we have helped close to 200 of them in the last 4 years. Third, upon the request of the county attorney, the criminal division assists in civil commitment hearings involving dangerous sexual predators. We also have an important medical fraud unit, which I won't go into for time's sake. Last thing I want to share with you is, I know this is not a budget discussion today, but I want you to know that the Attorney General's office brings real value to the state of Minnesota. During the 3.5 years from January 2019 to June 2020, the Attorney General's office brought in, returned, or saved Minnesotans more than $1.5 billion. Yes, I did say billion. The Attorney General's office, whether it's the opioid money, whether it's settlements that we have won in various cases, brings real value and brings far, far, far more value back to the state than you spend to run our office. Of that $1 billion, it represents savings to residential and small business utility ratepayers in the work we do with the Residential Utilities Division, and that's keeping energy costs down for seniors, for small businesses, for everyone. $300 million represents Minnesota's share of the $26 billion national settlement in opioids. $83 million is restitution or loan forgiveness to student borrowers who were defrauded. $81 billion is money my office won from Big Tobacco and R.J. Reynolds and ITG Brands for upholding the integrity of Minnesota's tobacco settlement. And as I noted last year, $26 million represents money the consumer action put directly back into the pockets and the family budgets of Minnesota families. And as I do these numbers, they don't include the $235 million more that we expect to bring in from settlements because of cases we settled in the last few weeks. I only point this out because it's important for you to know the full picture. And with that, Madam Chair, I will rest.
Thank you so much, Attorney General Ellison. Ms. Sales, did you? What we'd like to do next is to have the overview from the State Auditor's Office. Thank you very much. When you're ready to begin, if you'll please identify yourself and begin your presentation.
All right, good morning. Thank you, Chair Cleavorne. Thank you, Vice Chair Hewitt. Thank you, Lee Nash, and all the members of the committee. Really appreciate the opportunity to come in so early in the session and have a chance to talk with you today. So we are here to give a quick overview from the office. You may notice that you have more documents than that. We sent you kind of a bonus with what our budget ask will be as well. And you'll see that on the screen, but don't worry, we will save that for later. So spoilers are in that section. And with me today is Operations Director Matt Lindemann, if we want to get granular. So to start, just want to start out to tell you about our work. We oversee about $60 billion in government spending, mostly at the local level, but with the addition of the statewide single audit that we picked up last year, also federal spending at the state level. Our ultimate goal is to ensure that government funds are used for the purposes intended by law and that local governments and the state government hold themselves to the highest standards of fiscal accountability. That is our primary goal there. All right, my first time on this. And so, specifically, there are three main functions to what we do. And the first one, examinations. And that's where we ensure integrity. Those are audits, standards oversights, compliance checks, investigations. That's that function there. Our next function is support. We provide support, particularly to local government, particularly to small entities. And by doing things like management software, we develop policy, we provide direct consultation, and we conduct numerous trainings on financial practices. And then our final main function is analysis. We take that data that's sent in to us and we put it together in a way that you can use to make decisions based on facts. So we have a number of reports, and we also have other analyses that we can provide as well. Our team is made up of incredible financial professionals. I would argue we have some of the best audit professionals, analysts, researchers in the world. Our main office is at 525 Park, something that's a little bit new. My personal offices moved to the fifth floor of Centennial as my main office was off campus. We couldn't provide security in an adequate way, so I'm up on the fifth floor in Centennial. We have also offices in Duluth, Moorhead, Marshall, Rochester, and Mankato. We currently have 72 people on staff, including deputy auditors, six directors, and 20 staff in Greater Minnesota. Our organization is primarily in a structure of seven interconnected divisions. And with that, Director Lindemann will buzz through those quite quickly.
If you'll please state your name for the record.
Madam Chair, my name is Matthew Lindemann. I'm the Director of Budget, Finance, and Technology for the Office of State Auditor. I'm going to go over the organization of our office. The office is made up of seven divisions. The largest of these divisions is our audit division. Each year, audit performs financial and compliance audits, reviews single audits of state subrecipients, and provides technical assistance and education to local government finance staff. It recovers the costs of audits through audit fees and that are deposited with the general fund as non-dedicated revenue. The next division is our government information division. Is the primary source of Minnesota local government finance information in the U.S. It compiles financial information on Minnesota towns, cities, counties, and lobbying association. In addition to collecting information, it helps local governments by answering reporting questions and supporting the small city and town accounting system software program, which is also known as CTAS. The next division is our legal / special investigations division. It provides legal support to the whole office. In addition, it investigates allegations of theft and misuse of public funds. It coordinates with law enforcement when appropriate and posts its reports on the OSA's website as educational tools. The next division is our tax increment financing division, which has oversight of expenditures of TIF districts in the state. It identifies and communicates issues to TIF authorities for correction. It also works to educate TIF authorities so that they comply with the law. The TIF division is funded by a statutory appropriation collected from local government tax increments. So it's not a general fund. It does not affect our budget directly. The next division is our pension division, which supports local public pension plans. It collects and reports on financial information from these plans. It also responds to thousands of questions each year of volunteer firefighters who serve as trustees of these plans. The next division is my division, I should say, that supports the day-to-day operations of the entire office. It provides support in technology, office management, accounting, and budgeting for the entire office. And then finally, we have the Constitution Division, which provides office-wide management. It consists of the state auditor herself and her support staff. It coordinates legislative activities and policy development, provides communication support to the whole office, supports the state auditor on her seven boards that she serves on. A quick look at our budget shows that approximately 85% of the OSA's budget is dedicated to paying salaries and benefits. The audit division comprises 70% of the OSA's budget, with most of the costs being recovered through audit fees and indirect cost recoveries. Audit fees are based on actual costs of conducting audits. Since 2000, the OSA's general fund appropriation has dropped approximately 21% when adjusted for inflation. And finally, the OSA's budget is less than 5/100ths of a percent of the state's overall budget.
Thank you very much.
The math teacher me had to put that in there.
Thank you.
We have a couple more things.
Perfect.
Thank you. To talk briefly about our results. Now, this is something I'm going to get you a more detailed piece on. We do a longer piece on this, but our numbers are still coming in as we're finishing those up. Mm-hmm. Over the last 2 years, a couple of highlights. We found over $450 million in audit adjustments and counting. This is where we help get money where it's supposed to go at that local level. We found over $4.5 million in fraud and had a number of investigations that led to criminal prosecution. We certified over $600 million in state aid, like local government aid, some TIF aid, and a couple other spaces. We've trained over 2,000 people on fiscal integrity issues, mm-hmm. and we've overseen about $678 million in pension assets, primarily, again, in the Volunteer Fire Relief Association space. What you'll see, and I'll just give you a thing. Our services are becoming more and more demand. And I'm just going to show this quickly, just as a preview. Our budget change items are basically organized around the idea that audit resources are stretched really tight right now nationally. If any of you are in the accounting field, you know you're extremely popular right now. And as a result, we are building up some of the infrastructure around the work we do to stretch that work as far as we can, also to respond to increasing demand from law enforcement and the public for further investigations on that. As always, we really hope you contact us. If you think you want to put an audit in your bill, please call us. We may be able to find you a more cost-effective way to get at your oversight needs. We may be able to help you find something that's already happening. So we can definitely help you build out how that oversight can look. I think that most people who have talked to us have seen a reduction in their fiscal notes if they give us a call first. You'll also see our work this year. If you're on committees like taxes, we will have a tax increment finance clarification bill again coming through. And if you serve on the pension commission, you will also see our Fire Relief Association clarifying bill come through as well. We'll have positions, and we're here to support you on any other work you have. Please contact with us any way you can. Please write down this phone number. It's this phone here. I would love to talk with you further. And with that, we can either stand for questions or give you time to go to your next thing.
We will move on to the next presentation. But thank you, Auditor Blaha, for being with us. Thank you very much. Now we have the Legislative Coordinating Commission coming forward, and I appreciate your time and effort with us today. I have five members, or five individuals to testify. If we can just do a lightning round, 2 minutes each, and then we can adjourn on time, if that would be all right. All right, thank you. If you'll please state your name for the record and then begin your testimony.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Michelle Weber, and I'm the Executive Director of the Legislative Coordinating Commission. We're really happy to be with you this morning. We have each of the directors from the joint offices and commissions, and we are prepared to do just a 2-minute overview, but happy to answer more detailed questions, come back to the committee, or meet with any of you individually. Sometimes you will hear the Legislative Coordinating Commission, and that means two different things. So one is there's an oversight body, and I should have mentioned, included in your packets, in the interest of time, I didn't connect the technology, but included in your packets is a slide deck that we had put together. The Legislative Coordinating Commission is an oversight body that provides oversight and direction to all of the joint offices and commissions. Some of the joint offices have individual oversight bodies in addition to the Legislative Coordinating Commission, but it's reflective of the leadership in the House and the Senate. It's a 12-member body, 6 members from each of the House and the Senate, 4 from the majority and 2 from the minority. The joint offices will talk to you today, and many of us are funded through this committee, our operating resources. There's approximately 170 employees across all of the joint offices, and our total budget from this commission, from this committee, is about $45 million over the 2-year period, over our base budget. So with that, I will turn it over to Ms. Randall.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. For the record, my name is Judy Randall. I'm the Legislative Auditor. It's nice to see you all here today. Real quickly, the Legislative Auditor, despite its name, does not audit the legislature. We audit the state. We audit the executive branch agencies and really anywhere the state money goes. We do that in 3 different ways. We do audits, which you might guess from our name, financial audits. We audit the state's financial statements. We do internal control and compliance audits of executive branch agencies. We also do program evaluations. Those are directed by the legislature, the Legislative Audit Commission, which is our oversight commission, which I'll touch on briefly, directs us to evaluate about 6 state-funded programs each year. Those are kind of a broader look at programs, seeing if they're doing what the legislature intended, ensuring compliance, and then we make some recommendations usually for improvement. Finally, we do what's called special reviews. Those are ad hoc investigations or deeper dives. Our office receives, last year we received almost 350 different complaints, allegations, concerns, reports of data breaches or losses of state resources. We process all of those, and then we select a few that we think are especially concerning and do a deeper dive in those. We work year-round as your oversight body, and so if you have any questions or concerns, please reach out to us at any time. Our oversight commission, the Legislative Audit Commission, is bipartisan. We are nonpartisan. Our audit commission is made up of 3 members of each caucus, so it is even representation. Representative Hansen on this committee has been chair, vice chair, all sorts of things on that commission. So if you have questions about it, I'll volunteer him to guide you through that. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Christian Larson. I'm the director of the Legislative Budget Office. And the LBO has two core functions, the first of which is to provide the legislature with impartial estimates on the impact of proposed legislation. That occurs through really two processes. First, the fiscal note process, which is the impact on the state budget, and then the local impact note process, which looks at local budgets. Our second charge is to provide professional technical support to the Tax Expenditure Review Commission, and that commission does an annual review of tax expenditures in the state of Minnesota. The LBO was created in 2019. We started right before the 2020 legislative session, so we're going to our fourth session as an active office. The Tax Expenditure Review Commission was created in 2021 and started meeting last year, and so that work really has occurred over the last 12 months. The LBO budget is broken down into two components. The base budget for the local impact and fiscal process is $3.554 million, or $1.57 million per year. And the Tax Expenditure Review Commission has a base budget of $1.265 million. And that portion is overseen by the Tax Committee. The fiscal and local impact note process is overseen by the State Government Committee. We have 18 FTE, 13 of which are budgeted for the fiscal note process and the local impact note process, five of which are budgeted for the Tax Expenditure Review Commission. The other major cost component of our office is the lease of the fiscal note tracking system, which is the technology solution to run the fiscal note process. We have an oversight body, the LBO Oversight Commission, which oversees the work of our office. And we also, again, work with the Tax Expenditure Review Commission, which oversees our work related to tax expenditure reviews. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Lincoln. I'm the director of the Legislative Reference Library. We were started in 1969 with a mission to collect and provide information to legislators and staff. One of the primary ways we do that is to answer questions. We answer about 6,000 questions per year. Our collection of print and electronic materials is focused on state-level public policy issues, on current and historical information on the Minnesota legislature. We're the state's depository library, so we collect materials from all state agencies and archive those permanently. That provides transparency into the operations of state government. We have a terrific magazine collection that we use. We have alerting services to maximize the use of that collection and keep legislators and staff on top of the issues that they're facing. The library pays for key electronic resources on behalf of the legislature, so that includes newspaper access across the state, passwords to the Star Tribune, and other newspapers across the state, I guess. We provide also access to hundreds of electronic magazine resources. In addition, we provide specialized databases that staff around the legislature use, like the Bloomberg Tax Library, Westlaw, some other resources like that. Library staff collaborate on the legislature's website and have a particular special role in providing the search engine for the whole legislature. We compile historic legislative statistics and maintain a rich database of a lot of materials, but particularly biographical information about legislators. Our primary cost is staff, of course, and we have 13.75 full-time equivalent positions. We kept two positions open during the time we were working from home, but we have since filled those. The library's on the sixth floor. We also have a satellite location in the Senate building, a small reading room there. I'd be happy to answer any questions you have about the library. Thanks for your time.
Madam Chair, members, for the record, my name is Ryan Inman. I'm the Reviser of Statutes here at the Minnesota Legislature. The Reviser's Office is another one of your joint nonpartisan offices here. Our duties are codified under Minnesota Statutes Chapter 3C, but they can really be boiled down to we're here to help you. We've got 60-ish permanent and session-only employees. Those range from attorneys to drafting and editing assistants, legal editors, and IT professionals, as well as administrative support. Our services can really be thrown into three buckets. We've got legislative services, publication services, and IT services. The legislative side is exactly what you'd think it would be. We draft bills, we draft amendments. Towards the end of the session, you'll see us working on side-by-sides, conference committee reports. A lot of the services that we provide are similar to House research, except that we don't staff committees. We are a joint entity, so we don't do that. We do provide a rigorous quality control element for the legislature, so every bill that's introduced here crosses at least one of our lawyers' desks and is touched by a number of our editing staff. We're looking for the rules of grammar and our style, legal and constitutional review, and just generally making sure the words on the page mean what you think they do. As far as the publication duties are concerned, we are the official publisher of Minnesota statutes, Minnesota rules, and laws of Minnesota. Those are all published on a regular basis, depending on when we're working on them. Laws are every year, statutes are every other year, and rules are every other year as well. They're all available in print and electronically, and both of those versions are designated as official for legal proceedings here in the state of Minnesota. As far as IT services are concerned, we provide network storaging, processing, VoIP, we manage the telephones here, and we maintain the permanent database of all Minnesota law. We also support the website's functionality, and then finally, we've got the drafting system that we are primarily responsible for. I'll be bugging you about it later this year, just a heads up, but it really is the engine of the work that we do here, not just in our office, but the House and the Senate as well. So happy to answer questions. Otherwise, thanks for having us here.
Thank you.
I feel like the micro machine guy.
And Madam Chair, members, again, for the record, Michelle Weber. I am going to just speak very quickly about the last few slides. Susan Lincheski, the director of the Pension Commission, was unable to join us today, but she's happy to talk with you. There are three staff in the Pension Commission. Their operating resources are provided through the jurisdiction of this committee. It's approximately $1.2 million over the two-year period. There is a 14-member Pension Commission oversight body that governs the work of the Pension Commission. They take testimony on pension and retirement related bills, provide oversight to the public pension plans, and they also draft pension related bills. The Legislative Coordinating Commission, then the second way that the Legislative Coordinating Commission shows up is as an office, a joint office for the Minnesota Legislature. We serve as an umbrella organization for all of the joint offices with respect to human resources and fiscal services. We also staff a multitude. I believe there are 28 active joint commissions, and so we provide staff support to those commissions. We provide the GIS or the mapping services for the boundary information on behalf of the state. And then we also serve as a fiscal agent for significant legislative-wide activities, the membership to NCSL, the Council on State Governments, the public broadcasting and TV production. We serve as the fiscal agent for those types of activities. So with that, Madam Chair, that concludes our overview.
Thank you very much. I would like to thank each of you for the great work that you do for our state and for all Minnesotans. We couldn't do our great work without you, so thank you very much. I would also like to acknowledge Nash Boone, who is our new page and was with us today to help organize all of our materials. Thank you very much for your work. I would like the committee members to know and for the public to know our next meeting will be Tuesday, January 10th, 2023, with our business being completed for today. We are adjourned.